I'm David Brancaccio in for Tess Vigeland. During a financial crisis, it's become de rigueur to ask us to go out and spend to help spur the economy. Is that the answer to our economic woes?
The only way we can drive this economy forward is to save. Nations know that. You can only build from strength.
We'll hear candid words from a guy who runs one of the Federal Reserve banks. Consumer sales this, consumer sales that. Ever wonder who are these consumers?
Anyone comparing income trends can see that Warren Buffett and his peers have had very different experiences from most of us.
A call for distinguishing among different consumers. And sometimes spending and borrowing too much lands you deep, deep in debt. That debt could hurt your chances of getting a job.
It's a catch-22. I can't pay my student loans because I don't have a job. I can't get a job because I can't pay my student loans.
That story and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio, in for Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. Let me start by acknowledging I'm only a guest here, filling in for Tess Vigeland, just passing through. And as a guest, maybe it's impolite to point this out, but perhaps since I hosted Marketplace for 10 years, maybe I'm the one who can say it. Does this program have a fetish?
Of course, we should all be aiming to have at least 3 months in the bank for emergencies.
And then 20% goes for paying down debt and savings.
A rainy day fund should be at least 6 months.
Start socking away 10% of each take-home, each paycheck, toward that emergency fund.
Everybody just has to save more.
You listen for more than 5 minutes, and as night follows day, there's going to be somebody on Marketplace Money telling us to save. The prudent course, savings. Build up a nest egg, an emergency fund. Build those assets. Hoard your wealth. Don't sprinkle it around by spending. And apparently, you're listening, because there's word this week that late payments on credit cards are at their lowest levels in 17 years. Americans being prudent, not spending beyond their means. And if you keep at this savings binge and you persuade your friends and neighbors to do the same, congratulations, you may just kill the economy. We say save, but the messages to do the other thing, spend, come at you from so many other sides. Advertising, manufacturing desire, and that persistent pitch that the economy needs your dollars to keep the double dip away. Or is it save to help the economy? Which is it? When the economic crisis hit after the mortgage and credit markets seized up, President Obama weighed in with this.
We've got to spend some money now to pull us out of this recession. But as soon as we're out of this recession, we've got to get serious about starting to live within our means.
Confused? With this new wave of economic uncertainty gripping this late summer, under what circumstances should we spend or borrow or save? We talked to some people on the streets of New York and in Grand Central Station about their sense of things. Here's what they had to say.
I think to a certain extent, consumers need to spend more to help the economy. We all recognize it's a difficult time. On the other hand, everyone has their own means, so you're going to need to do your own assessment of what your personal finances allow.
Well, nothing else seems to be working. Maybe a boost from the Fed will give us a little more stimulus that we need, put some people back to work, you know, infrastructure projects, Roosevelt all over.
I think the practical thing, though, is that a lot of people don't understand why they how their own personal consumer spending would stimulate the economy. And perhaps if there was more information out there, then, you know, that they would realize that it does, every little bit of spending does help, then people would be spending more.
Yes, I do think that we should spend money to help the economy, because when you put money into something, it then kind of starts up the, you know, the business of it, regardless of an amount of profit or amount of revenue. It still will be able to create some kind of business instead of no money, which doesn't create business at all.
And everyone's talking about how the stimulus package did not work, but I think it didn't work in the first place because there wasn't enough stimulus to begin with. And I think if the Congress can do something about it, we should spend more money on it.
We should absolutely be spending more money to help the economy. It's absolutely crazy that you wouldn't. People always use the example of we should be like a business and, you know, we need to make sure that we're not spending more than we have. But let's say you have a shipping business. You got a bunch of boats. They all have holes in them. So your employees are out of work. You're losing money. What are you going to do? You're going to take out a loan. You're going to spend the money to fix your ships, get your employees back to work, and start earning money again so you can start making money.
Thomas Honig is president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. For another couple of weeks, he's hitting the mandatory retirement age, 65, and that's it. But even before he was a short-timer, Mr. Honig was a remarkably outspoken regional Fed president. He joins us from Kansas City. Mr. Honig, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
We had an economy based on consumer spending, and when central bankers in Washington say we need low interest rates to keep people spending and the economy growing, who are we to argue that more spending might be a problem?
My issue with that is it has a very short-term focus, and I understand transition economics. But the fact of the matter is, David, we have, as a nation, for the last two decades, systematically consumed more than we've produced as a nation. Now, the only way you can do that over a longer period of time like that is to have very low interest rates and to increase your debt, increase the leverage of the individual, increase the leverage of the country. And the best illustration of that is when you think back two decades, the debt of the consumer as a percent of their disposable personal income was between 80 and 90%. And then over time, until the peak in about 2007 and 8, it increased to 125% of disposable income. That's not sustainable. And our economy reflects that fact. So now the adjustment takes place. We're over-leveraged. And in the meantime, to try and ease that transition, we've decided to keep interest rates very low, zero, for an extended period. And we've asked our federal government to borrow trillions of dollars and leverage its own balance sheet to help with the transition. The danger of that, of course, is that we continue to encourage leverage. We disadvantage the saver who can make nothing on their savings, zero. 1% is a long-term CD these days. And I think it's very strongly disadvantageous to the nation over the long run, it seems.
But can we run an economy where people, once and for all, really do save? If you get your wish, will there be enough resources out there to drive the economy forward?
Well, the only way we can drive this economy forward is to save. Nations know that. You can only build from strength. And strength comes with the right amount of savings so that you can have funds, real funds, not artificial printed money, available to buy plant and equipment, to help entrepreneurs get started, to build businesses, to produce things. And when you produce those things, then people have money and income and they buy those things. I understand there's what we refer to as a paradox of thrift. If everyone saves too much at once, the outcome can be a worse recovery. As a nation, we need to think about the long run, how we're going to deal with our long-run debt. We need to think about how we rebalance this economy. If you fail to save, if all you can do is consume and borrow from the rest of the world and import their goods, then you make yourself poorer over the long run.
You know, of course, Japanese people like to save, but they're not doing so well. For 20-some years, they've had that problem, and they save like crazy.
Yes, they do save. It has come down. That's why it's allowed their government to borrow extensive amounts for a longer period than they otherwise would. But the fact of the matter is they have chosen to be primarily export-oriented. They didn't have a balanced economy either. They saved very high so they could export goods. Now, what they did during their boom period was, of course, print a lot of money, and they had significant asset bubbles that they created, which then undermined their very banking system. And when their crash came, those banks were highly leveraged, and they're still recovering from that mistake. The fact that you temporarily live very well by borrowing is a very familiar story through history, and the outcome is almost always the same: a crisis, people out of jobs, and a long recovery.
What I'm hearing from you is this. Back during the housing boom, it seemed good for the economy for people to buy houses with these low interest rates and then go to the hardware store to fix up the houses and the furniture store. That seemed good for the economy, but it created a distortion in the real estate market that has hurt us all. And we actually have the example of what you're talking about. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. That's exactly what I'm saying. It wasn't just that some people were buying a home to live in and so forth. They were refinancing the home to fund their consumption. Between the period of 2002 and 2007, there were about 3 million more homes built than households formed. And what happens when supply exceeds demand? Prices fall. And during that period, people who had homes, who had equity, they decided to cash out that equity, borrow against their home. That meant you were increasing your debt that you had to pay back someday. And then when prices began to level off and then fall, that all became debt that they had to repay, and the house wasn't even worth the amount of debt they had. Now we have to go through that adjustment. I wish there was a painless way. I wish there was a shortcut, but we all know what happens when you take shortcuts. You tend to find yourself in the ditch, and that's what I'm worried about.
Thomas Hoenig, outgoing president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. Thank you very much, sir.
You're very welcome. It's good to be with you.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. Today we've posed the question, what is the consumer's role in the economic recovery? Should we be spending or saving? Well, that probably depends on the condition of your finances, right? Although we're in a recession, some people still have the money to spend. And data on this subject suggest some folks are doing just that. But commentator Rob Walker says in order to really understand the consumer's role in the economic recovery, we need to better understand just who the consumer is.
What do you, me, Warren Buffett, and millions of unemployed Americans have in common? We're all consumers, meaning we all exchange money for goods and services. So all those reports of consumers cutting back or the consumer's recession mentality are about us, all of us, you, me, and Warren. Maybe that's why those reports are so hard to understand. One says sales of stoves have fallen, another says sales of TVs have risen. One story suggests that even dollar stores are feeling the pinch. Another marvels that Apple, thanks to booming sales of top-end phones and computer tablets, has more cash than the U.S. government. One day we hear luxury goods are selling well, the next that Americans are cutting back on discretionary services. Hold on, isn't luxury discretionary? Of course it is, but according to the Federal Reserve, education and insurance are discretionary services too, along with dinner and a movie. Confused? You're not alone. Every month, economists struggle to find meaning in consumption numbers. What we need are more precise methods of assessing spending data, methods that acknowledge that there is more than one flavor of the consumer. Pundits and policy wonks have all acknowledged that anyone wanting to diagnose the economy has to get specific. Take labor. People studying American workers use the terms blue collar and white collar. They're relatively crude distinctions, but they're indispensable to any analysis. Anyone comparing income trends can see that Warren Buffett and his peers have had very different experiences from most of us. So why haven't the experts come up with distinctions for consumers? Every day we hear how important consumers are to our economic recovery. But if we want to figure out what's going on with consumers, what we want consumers to be doing, and which policies might help, we need to find some way to answer a basic question. Which consumers, exactly, are we talking about?
Rob Walker is a contributing writer for Design Observer and the New York Times Magazine. A lousy credit score can shock your world in some unexpected ways.
And the recruiter told me that she had taken a look at my credit check, and my credit was an issue, and they could not hire me.
We'll hear how employers are using credit reports to vet job applicants. It's coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I wonder what Shakespeare would have written on savings versus spending during a time of extra uncertainty. Can't help you with that. But we did call up our friends at Live Wire Radio in Portland, Oregon for their dramatic take.
Diana, you here?
Yeah, what's wrong?
Nothing's wrong, honey. Everything's right.
What are you talking about? Is that your brother out there?
Yeah, hang on. Hey, Mike, come on in here. Diane, Mike and I figured it out.
Figured what out?
A way out of this financial mess.
No, we already found a way, honey. We're watching our spending. We're adding to our savings every month, remember?
Okay. But let me add a wrinkle.
Uh-huh.
The whole saving idea is great, okay? But the Fed just locked interest rates because it's time to spend.
Uh-oh.
Sweetie, consumer spending is what drives our economy. You're being un-American.
I'm unemployed. That's about as American as you can get these days.
Did you tell her?
Mike, okay, I was just about to. All right, Diane, picture this. We are building a giant mattress.
Come again?
Giant mattress!
Remember how during the Great Depression, the banks weren't safe to put your money in? So where did they keep all their money?
In their mattresses!
Okay, you bought a giant mattress?
No, silly head. You can't just buy a giant mattress. Not even online. We're going to build it.
Out of what?
7,000 pounds of batting, 30,000 yards of fabric, and all the springs I could get from an abandoned pogo stick factory.
Okay, what did you use to buy all this?
Just all our credit cards and savings and bonds and my corn collection and Mike's kidney money.
I'm just glad it went toward a sound investment.
Hang in there, Mike. Then we just put everything we own that's worth anything into the mattress. Our house, the cars, the kids' braces.
They're still attached to the kids, honey.
Well, they'll go in, too. We'll all go in.
Along with the flat-screen TVs and pizza oven that we bought to keep us living in mattress-y comfort until this all blows over.
Oh, Mike's coming, too?
Sure am.
Okay. All right, honey. Before I hit you in the head with the frying pan, and I will hit you with the frying pan, but before I do, how exactly does spending all of our money solve all our financial problems?
Well, I didn't spend it all so much as invested in mattress futures. Our mattress future. Eating delicious brick oven pizzas and watching season 2 of Doctor Who while encased in 10 feet of soft posturepedic batting to protect us from a financial world gone crazy.
Sweetheart, you've gone round the bend.
I thought it was cool.
But you're a moron.
True.
All right. We'll do your plan, but let me add a wrinkle. We don't do your plan.
Honey!
Listen to me. First, you're going to return everything.
Oh, everything?
Everything except season 2 of Doctor Who. Then we'll order a pizza and we'll sit on our perfectly soft and comfortable couch that I don't want to live inside of and discuss any future investments.
So you don't even want to consider panicking?
Maybe later.
I was really looking forward to moving in with you guys.
Maybe you still can, Mike. Honey?
I'm getting the frying pan.
Mike, run.
Our mattress future sketch was written, performed, and produced by Live Wire Radio in Portland, Oregon. If you're hankering for more Marketplace this weekend, given everything going on in financial markets and the economy, you can check out our one-hour special to explore where the U.S. economy is headed. It's part of Marketplace's ongoing coverage, The Breakdown, Our Economy One Step at a Time. If you have an iPhone, you can hear it by downloading the new Marketplace iPhone app or listen to the special at marketplace.org. One of the reasons so many people regularly proselytize for savings on this program is that the effects can be far-reaching and severe. And when I say spending, it's not just spending on the espresso machine upgrade or a Nikon D3X. The spending can be for even more defensible reasons, like an advanced degree, which seems like a worthy investment. That is, until the new master's degree in international relations ends up battering your credit rating and job prospects. Listen to the story of a 38-year-old woman denied a job because of what spending on education did to her credit report.
My name is Saran Scholler. I am from Chicago, born and raised on the South Side. I decided to go back to school to get a better education to make myself more marketable.
After a successful career in human resources, the irony of this will become clear in a minute. So Scholler finishes her master's program, connects with her old network of contacts, and plunges back into the job market in 2008. 2008, that ghastly job market. But then, in 2009, she gets a call from a recruiter about a job in human resources, her field. She applies, does an interview.
And I never heard from them, so I called back, and the recruiter told me that she had taken a look at my background, doing a credit check, and my credit was an issue and they could not hire me.
The problem was the student loans. With no job, she couldn't pay. She called the loan company and they said, you gotta give something.
But there was nothing to give and they asked me if I could borrow it. My mother is on a fixed income. She's retired. My sister has been laid off and my brother wasn't working. I was the primary money giver in the family.
Still, she kept trying for jobs.
I was looking to just make some money, whether that was I was your virtual secretary. Heck, if I was your barista, it didn't matter at that point, but I could not find work. It's a catch-22. I can't pay my student loans because I don't have a job. I can't get a job because I can't pay my student loans.
It's no fluke, Saran Scholler's experience. A new study finds 6 out of 10 employers use credit reports to vet job applicants. Amy Traub is with the public policy think tank Demos.
I found this very surprising. And I immediately wondered, on what basis is a credit report being sought here? And I found that it's not on any basis. There's no evidence that the credit report will tell a prospective employer anything.
Traub says crummy credit can have as much to do with the state of the economy as it does with the spending choices we make.
What happens when you're out of work like that for months on end? People run through their savings, they start to have difficulty paying bills on time, and finally you have another job in sight. The end of this long period of unemployment is finally at an end. And then Americans are denied employment, and that's just unfair, and really it's unproductive for the economy as a whole.
Several human resources experts we spoke with said they discourage companies from using credit screening except where the job is especially sensitive, a position in banking, for instance. Recruiting consultant Jerry Thurber of Tandem Select in Colorado says even then, a person's credit should only be used to prompt more research on an applicant if there are red flags. Several states have cracked down on credit reports used in hiring, but Thurber says he hopes regulation does not go overboard.
Some states have done sort of blanket statements saying you may not use credit history as part of the background screen. And I think they're missing the boat there because, clearly it is one data element among seven or eight data elements that help an employer make an intelligent hiring decision.
Federal legislation to limit credit checks in hiring keeps getting introduced into Congress, where to date it has gone nowhere fast. You should know you already have the right under federal law to be told if your credit report is the reason you're not getting the job. And what about Saran in Chicago, who chose to spend down her savings and take loans for a master's that she hoped would make her a stronger job candidate? This week, a company has tossed her a bit of human resources consulting work, a couple of days' worth.
It's more likely 1.5 days now, but I have to say they really are trying. Have they run my credit? No, because I'm a contractor, so they didn't have to.
So credit scores, they're not just about getting a loan anymore, which brings us back to our consumer conundrum this week. Are we prudently saving or prudently spending more to help the economy? And if there's borrowing involved, how is our credit? Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here. And it's something that Joy from Seattle, Washington, had a couple questions about. Hi, Joy. How are you?
I'm great. How are you guys?
Well, we're hanging in here. So what is the issue here? How's your credit?
My credit is in great shape. The problem is that my fiancé's is in not so great shape.
How'd you find out about that?
We sat down and had a talk about our finances as we were kind of planning for our future together and together pulled our credit reports and looked at our scores. The problem being mostly that he doesn't have any credit.
Oh.
He doesn't have any student loans. He doesn't have any auto loans. His kind of take on money is if you have it, you can spend it, but you don't spend more than you have.
Okay.
The problem being that to build your credit, you have to have credit. And if you have none, it's very hard to get any.
So Chris Farrell, that is a role reversal. It's not that he has bad credit. It's that he's been so prudent that the financial system doesn't know whether to trust him or not.
Okay. I'm getting up on my soapbox for a moment. So here's somebody who doesn't spend more than he earns. And he's penalized for this in our system. We have this whole credit scoring machinery that's tied around borrowing. But we have nothing that says, well, you put $100 a month into your savings account. Bingo. You get a higher credit score. No, it doesn't even count. You paid your rent on time. Oh, well, I don't really care about that either. So it's such a bizarre situation that we're in that the people who are doing what we actually recommend week after week get penalized.
There has to be a way that in coming up with a credit profile that you get some brownie points for that kind of behavior. But at the moment, you typically don't.
You don't.
So what could Joy do? Get him a little credit card. He could pay it back every month.
We're doing that. The problem is that without really any credit, we got a Capital One secured credit card, which is great. It's a $200 limit. And while it is secured, $200 is, if that's your only credit, your utilization ratio doesn't work very well.
What sort of time frame are we talking about that this is actually going to matter?
Yeah, I mean, we do have time, but I feel like I tend to panic about things and get this feeling that the world's going to end if we don't take care of it right away. So we're planning on getting married probably next August or September. I own a condo that we would need to sell before we could purchase a home together. But, you know, if we were able to, we might be looking to do that next, you know, summer, late spring, summer.
Okay, so you got plenty of time on your side. I think you've actually done the right thing with the secured card. You typically don't want to exceed 30% of your credit limit. So he does that. He does it for about a year, and then he transfers into a traditional credit card.
Okay.
Now, Joy, you've been thinking about this as well, and you have a strategy that you wanted to try out on us. What is it?
Well, it's a suggestion from my mother. When I was in college and we were trying to build my credit, she added me, or I added her to my credit card or something in there. Her credit was really good, and so not long after that, the credit limit on my cards were being increased dramatically. So my mom suggested if we added him to one of my cards, would that show then on his credit report that he has, you know, this $10,000 credit limit on his report maybe? Mm-hmm.
Chris, that's an interesting strategy. Would it help a fellow to be kind of a co-signer on one of these credit cards for a while?
Right. So this is what we call being an authorized user. So it's a way that he gets all the advantages and he doesn't have to necessarily take the time. I'm going to, this is, you know, and I just have to say this, going to put out there, I don't want to be Dr. Doom. I don't want to be Dr. Gloom. But I don't like the idea of authorizing until after the words, I do. I'm being extremely conservative here, but I just think that's one of those rules that it's just good to follow after marriage. Then I would just go and get a joint credit card.
Okay. And when you do that, they're going to run your credit. They'd run both of us individually and then approve it based on the conglomeration of our
right. So
histories.
Yours is going to have a lot of weight, but you have a really good. You make a joint application. They'll run the credit report on both of you. But he's been using his card on a regular basis, paying it off monthly. He's going to actually have a nice little credit history. So you're going to be in a really good position to get a good card.
Okay. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much, Joy.
Enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
We wanted to do more than just wish people with bad credit reports good night and good luck, given how so many Americans are just a layoff or illness away from a crumbling credit score. Question is, how much can be done? Adam Allington reports from St. Louis Public Radio, there are ways to clean it up.
Nicole Shalady's first experience with credit was relatively innocent, just one of those low-limit cards they offer at clothing retailers. But it wasn't long before all that changed. Her high 700 credit score paved the way for more and more debt.
I was able to open pretty much any credit card I applied for, and I was able to get my limits raised. So the higher they went, the more I spent.
At one point, Shalady had so much debt that she sometimes had to skip card payments, which killed her credit score.
I'm actually afraid to look at it today.
Why are you afraid? What do you think it might be?
It's got to be back in the 500s at least, I'm sure. It's scary to see how far I know it's dropped.
Now, at 28 years old, Shalady is gradually paying down her debt, but not without some creative choices, including selling her eggs to fertility clinics.
I think if I had good credit and not a lot of debt, I might have considered it once, but I've done it 4 times.
And while that might seem like a painful way to manage debt, it turns out that our brains actually register spending as pain, and credit softens the blow of big purchases.
You see the price and your brain goes, ouch. And in fact, they've seen this ouch on brain scans.
Cynthia Kreider teaches consumer psychology at Washington University. That ouch she describes is the pain of paying.
Often people think of the credit limit that they've received like money in their pocket. So then when they're spending credit, they're reducing that money that they've already received rather than actually going into debt, which going into debt is exactly what they're doing.
And the process of accumulating debt is lined with traps, missed payments, variable interest rates, all of which send credit scores plunging. And once you're down, there are a few quick ways back up.
There's no magic wand that's going to fix your score and increase it 200 points.
Anissa Sharif is a credit and debt counselor at Personal Debt Solutions. Sharif says there's lots of legitimate companies that will help clean up your credit score, including haggling with lenders to remove credit score blemishes in exchange for paying the balance off.
Well, an average credit repair program costs about $300 to $500 in that range. And, you know, that would definitely improve your score from 40, you know, points onwards. And sometimes 40 points is really what anyone needs.
That's about all Randall Nicholson needed to improve his credit score. He and his wife were looking to move into a bigger house. They were shocked when their mortgage was denied.
We have two kids and, you know, they were sharing. We had his only two bedrooms, so they're sharing a room. And we really needed to get a new house and we had no idea what to do.
It turned out they only had a few missed payments on long-forgotten accounts, so they decided to hire a credit counselor. Now Nicholson pulls out his laptop and shows me his score.
So as you can see here, the highest actually bumped to 724, and I think originally our credit score was in the, I want to say like 650 around there.
Within 6 months, Nicholson was able to buy that bigger home, and even though the process of cleaning up a credit score can be frustrating, the rewards for good credit have never been higher. Home mortgage rates continue to drop, in some cases as low as 3.75%, but only for people with stellar credit, around 750 and up, which means a $300 or $400 investment to clean up your credit could come back as much bigger savings. In St. Louis, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace Money.
Is the idea of a consumer-led recovery just a fairy tale?
You're paying a lot for gas, you're paying more at the supermarket, your credit card bills keep increasing, and so we have this completely divided society.
We'll look at how the consumer is faring in this economy. You're listening to Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. Okay, parsing this mystery wrapped in an enigma, saving for our own goods, spending for, among other things, the good of the country. But who wants to spend when the economy's so unpredictable these days? I'm talking to people throughout the show about what we'll call the consumer conundrum. Enter now the man with expertise, an old friend, Chris Farrell, our official economics editor. Hi, Chris.
And Mr. Conundrum, it's great to be with you again.
So what do we have here? Interest rates are freakishly low. The guardians of these things at the Fed say they plan to keep things that way for maybe 2 years. Tempting low interest rates. Maybe you want to borrow, but do people want to get more into hock during times like these?
Well, if I'm putting on my personal finance hat, if your finances are stretched, I don't care how low rates are. Don't borrow. Now, I know that puts me on one side of the conundrum, but I guess that's the conundrum.
And I might add, do you really need the thing that you're borrowing for? It's another good question to ask.
Yes.
And in fact, let's delve into this. Let's bring on Dan from Bar Harbor, Maine. Dan wrote in looking for some guidance on issues connected to this. Hello, Dan.
Hello.
So Bar Harbor, Maine in the summer?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm not just faking that. I'm actually from about 2 hours west of you.
Oh, you are.
Yeah.
You're a New Englander.
I am, in fact, a Mainer. Now, do you live in Bar Harbor itself? That's a pretty fancy place.
Well, I actually work in Bar Harbor, and I lived there for quite some time, but we've bought a home just about 30 miles north of Bar Harbor.
How long have you been in the house?
We've lived here about 7 years.
Wow. Now, that can be paradise. So what's your question, Dan?
Well, the problem I have is the home we're in is perfectly fine. We have a very low mortgage. We're actually able to save money. We have a young family we're raising. My wife, I think, wants to ball it all up, the savings, the equity, and everything, and throw it into a big, giant mortgage into another home.
Another home? A bigger home?
Okay.
A bigger home, which, you know, would be nice to have a little more space, but it's certainly not necessary. We've got all we need in a home right now.
So, Chris Farrell, it sounds like already we're in that question, the distinction between needing something and wanting something.
Correct.
That's right. You know, when I think about this and, you know, over a longer period of time, you know, a lot of this is, you know, we're talking about saving and we're talking about spending and, you know, taking advantage of these low interest rates. But we don't save to save. We save to spend. And so part of while you're talking, Dan, I was thinking about, boy, you have a small home, but it sounds like, you know, it meets your needs. It allows you to save. Over a longer period of time, you can spend on lots of things. Whereas you put all this money into a big house, that's what you may end up spending your money on. That may be what defines your lifestyle.
But Dan, it may meet your needs. It doesn't sound like it meets the needs of your spouse. What's her name?
Her name's Megan.
And she's looking for something a little what? Better, bigger?
A little better, a little bigger. I attribute a lot of it to 7 straight years of watching this HGTV.
That cable channel is designed to be a desire-inspiring device. That's what it does for a living.
I see that.
Is she that way? She kind of likes to buy things?
Well, she's usually very responsible with our money. As a matter of fact, she's about 90% of the reason why we're in such a good position today. I'm just really worried that we're taking ourselves out of a comfortable situation and throwing ourselves into a situation that is going to be double the mortgage and just a lot more stress and strain on trying to raise our family.
Well, Dan, just tell me, what kind of work do you and your wife do?
I'm a seasonal chef in Bar Harbor, and my wife is, well, I guess she's sort of a seasonal worker, too. She's a fourth grade teacher.
And do you have some savings to help with the down payment if you're going to do this thing?
Yes, we do. You know, we could probably, you know, put together about $20,000. So it would take all of our equity and all of our savings and everything to get us into this $250,000 to $275,000 house and piece of land that she wants to put us on.
I can hear you sounding a bit concerned, Chris.
I'm very concerned because it's not just that you take on a bigger mortgage, but also the cost of maintenance is higher, the property casualty insurance is higher. I mean, all your costs increase. So what about a compromise? What about a remodeling? If there's a need for some extra space or there's a need for an upgrade in the kitchen or some part of the house, you know, whether that might go toward improving the quality, the appearance, the livability of the place where you are, but it doesn't take on all this extra debt, all these extra costs.
Well, you're spot on with that.
Meanwhile, in a car on Route 1 near Bar Harbor, your wife has the radio on and is listening to this, and she's just been persuaded by all your reasoned arguments, and actually your problems are over.
Well, that sounds great. I've already went ahead and told her what's going on. Your producer was speaking to me one day, and I just didn't want to have her hear me in the background discussing our finances and our life with someone on the phone. So I told her, and now she's going around telling people, you know, Daniel's about to go on NPR and throw me under the bus.
Well, I do have a tiny recommendation for just a small bit of spending.
Mm-hmm.
You need to find a nice restaurant so you and your spouse can go and discuss this calmly and quietly. But when you come up for air and it's all worked out, please let us know how it went, okay?
I certainly will. And I thank you, gentlemen, very much for your time.
Thank you, Dan. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Let me make our savings versus spending inquiry here as tangible as aluminum, steel, and rubber. Think of a parking lot with 300,000 brand spanking new cars as far as the eye can see. Sparkling Fords, Cadillacs, Audis still covered with factory fresh plastic film. Now vaporize them, and the lot goes empty. Market researchers at J.D. Powers estimated this week that weakening consumer sentiment means 300,000 fewer light vehicles will be sold in America this year. That's you and me, worried about jobs, house values, debt, saying, nah, better stick with the 2003 Taurus, meaning auto workers get less to do and have less to spend, which drags down the economy further. But is that really our problem? We have a roundtable pulled together here with Karen Dinan, who focuses on household finance at Brookings, and Jeff Harding, who publishes The Daily Capitalist. Karen, Jeff, hi.
Hi, David.
Hello, David.
Karen, what do you think? I mean, in a sense, it's not a choice for many of us. We really couldn't spend if we even had the impulse.
There are certainly a lot of households going through a lot of hardship right now who don't have the capacity to do more spending. But I do think that there are households with capacity but that are being held back by a high degree of anxiety and despair about the future. There have been significant doubts that have arisen about our policymakers' ability to grapple with key economic challenges as people saw Washington go through this disarray. Those things have all led to this pessimism, which really can be self-fulfilling. I mean, if people wake up and they see a grimmer future, they're going to do less spending than they otherwise would do, which leads businesses to cut back on hiring and in turn depresses income and, in fact, reduces people's capacity to spend.
But, Karen, they also are looking at those really sweet low interest rates. That has to be some kind of enticement. And if they can be enticed, is that the right course?
The fact is that with consumer spending accounting for about 70% of the economy, we need solid growth in this area to have a self-sustaining recovery.
Now, Jeff, I've been reading your stuff. It really sets your teeth on edge when you hear calls for more consumer spending. But what are we really talking about here? Government policies to persuade you to spend? I mean, that's what really you're worried about, essentially stimulus.
Yeah, the problem with stimulus is they keep trying the same things over again and they haven't worked. Unemployment keeps going up again. It's 9.2%. GDP is down to 1.3%. Industrial production has been falling for the last 13 months. No wage growth. You can't keep borrowing and spending to make this economy grow.
Karen Dinan, maybe it's just that the stimulus hasn't been enough. I mean, if we're trying to have consumers pop to life, there just hasn't been quite enough of the stimulus that was needed into the face of the economic downturn that we've been through.
I think one can easily debate, particularly in hindsight, whether every dollar that we spent trying to stimulate the economy was spent in the most effective way. But I think in a big picture sense, the economy is in much better shape. Even though the economy isn't in very good shape right now, it's in much better shape than it would have been had we not had these programs. But I do think there is more that the government can do now.
But isn't this the precise time that if you're making a spending decision for yourself or a savings decision for yourself, that in fact you should be cautious and save? The rational course now is not to spend.
In terms of the macro economy, of course we want to be encouraging more spending in order to jumpstart the economy into a more durable recovery. You know, as for whether any given household should be spending more or saving more right now, that's really going to have to do with the specific financial situation the household is in.
And in a sense, Jeff, we're all, when we sit around with our significant others going through the bank statements and deciding how to allocate our money, we're all micro. None of us is macro at that moment. And so it may be that we're just going to rein in our horns and not spend so much when we're looking at headlines like we've been seeing from Wall Street.
Well, I agree with you. I think it's the rational thing for consumers to do. I mean, we've had so much stimulus that has failed us. And, you know, you look around and who has benefited from the stimulus? It's basically been Wall Street. It hasn't been Main Street. We've seen what's happening to treasuries. Basically, yields went down again today. Treasuries went up. And all that does is harm savers. So we have basically some economic growth, but what we have really is a bifurcated economy.
The bifurcated economy. I've been waiting for you to say something like this because I clipped this thing from Advertising Age not long ago. It was about growing income inequality in this country, the middle class disappearing, and what that means for companies. It was quite eye-opening. The research report from Ad Age made the case that some firms may just have to sell to the wealthy few. Quote, "It appears that mass affluence may be a thing of the past, and that," again, quoting, "marketers should reconsider how their products appeal to elite consumers." In other words, just worry about the top end of the income scale because the rest of them are just not going to be able to spend.
I just saw the number the other day that 64% of Americans can't come up with $1,000 in case of an emergency. Yet you see Wall Street making millions and billions of dollars at a time. What's happening is that capital is being redirected there instead of where it ought to go, and that's to Main Street. And it's just not happening.
Karen, how are we going to get out of this mess? What has to happen?
Well, we need to see more demand in the economy. We also need to take steps to spur spending today. Some of that is going to be by undertaking policies that will support incomes, create jobs, Some of that is simply by fixing the perception that Washington is dysfunctional and policymakers simply can't address key economic challenges. If we can address that problem, that's a way to make both households and businesses more confident to spend, you know, and for businesses less reluctant to hire.
So that's all we have to do. We have to fix our democracy. I'll get cracking on that, though, Karen. That'll be my my burden for the rest of the weekend. All right, Karen Dinan at Brookings Institution, Jeff Harding at the Daily Capitalist. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks, David.
What does Tier 1 capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
My favorite New York bureau chief, Marketplace's Heidi Moore, joins us before we go. Heidi, you holding up given market conditions?
Yes, just like everybody else, I'm living on coffee and hope, but it's going okay.
You know, you sent a memo to your colleagues in Los Angeles this week with a very Heidi headline, I have to say. Let me quote it. A consumer recovery. We don't have one, but who needs it anyway? It sounds like you're seeing the theme of this program that we've just been doing everywhere you look.
It is everywhere that we look. Where is the consumer in this recovery? We keep hearing about companies that are doing really well and have hordes of cash, more than they know what to do with. The banks are doing pretty well. Things are kind of motoring along. The stock market, for the most part, is having a great year, except for the last 3 weeks. And yet, you look around you when you're a consumer, and what do you see? You're paying a lot for gas. You're paying more at the supermarket. Your credit card bills keep increasing, and a lot of your neighbors are unemployed. And so we have this completely divided society that makes no sense. And yet, there are a lot of people making money still. And it's only now that we're guessing that we may enter another recession. How nuts is that? Everyone feels like the first recession never ended.
In fact, there are some gauges of this. I remember when I was just a lad back in the 70s, everybody was paying attention to the misery index, especially during those highly inflationary times. You found another distress index. What is it?
Yeah, the Credibility Consumer Distress Index. Good times, right? So you need an index, obviously, to tell you how bad things are in case you can't look out your window. And this particular index measures on a scale of 1 to 100 how deeply within the fetal position we are as consumers. Right now, we're in the mid-60s, which is not good. That does indicate some distress. But the upside of all of that is because things have been so rough for so long, apparently Americans are getting a little better at managing their budgets if they have budgets. So there's always a silver lining. At least we're thinking more carefully about the value of a dollar, even if the value of the dollar is plummeting.
A perfect restatement of the paradox of this program that we've been examining. Then we get to this idea of measuring the health of our economy by how much we all spend and how much we buy, that being the great yardstick of our wonderfulness.
That's right. If you're not buying, you're just not American. But some people object to that, surprisingly. One of them, one of the smartest people I know, is Mike Mandel. He's an economist at the Progressive Policy Institute, and he has been against this measure of consumption as something that measures our health for a long time. So I called him up, and I asked him what he's thinking about it these days. Here's what he said.
I'd like to see consumption knocked off as this great moral good. It is not true that Americans have to consume in order for the economy to function. It just doesn't work that way. It's about really what kind of life we want to live. Do we want to think of ourselves as consumers, or do we want to think of ourselves as producers?
It's really parallel, Heidi, to this whole notion that I've been doing a lot of coverage on about, is the GDP the great measure of all that is wonderful? Maybe we should measure what brings us well-being, what makes us happy even.
Yes, exactly. And a lot of other countries have been experimenting with that. England has been looking at a well-being index. And why wouldn't we try that? Because the weird thing about GDP is that the things that contribute to the economy may not be the things that contribute to our own feeling of doing well. So, for instance, divorces and death are contributors to GDP because you have to pay lawyers, you have to pay morticians. But obviously, divorces and death are things that bring us back a little bit as people. In the same way that it takes people a long time to get over unemployment, those are things that prevent people from being fully productive for a while, and yet they boost GDP. So maybe this is a good time to start questioning our premises as long as we're rebuilding.
And measuring something else. All right. Marketplace's New York Bureau Chief, Heidi Moore, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
By the way, I got your other memo about keeping the Bureau's kitchen clean.
Yeah, it was getting pretty gross.
It wasn't me.
Yeah, it's never anybody.
That's Marketplace Money for this week. Tess, back next week. Be sure to friend us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter. I'm simply fascinating. Ask anyone. It's economy4_O for Twitter. Next time, interest rates low, consumer spending down. This should be a good time to buy a used car, right?
I mean, let's face it. People are still in that sort of used car frame of mind, and that's definitely driven the prices up.
So maybe not. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm David Brancaccio. Tess Vigeland will be back next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.